Hello, I'm Matt Baum, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On this week's episode, disaster films and gay romance. My guest this week is New York Times bestselling author Christopher Rice, whose new book Sapphire Sunset is a passionate, steamy gay romance novel. Christopher didn't think he'd grow up to be a writer, despite coming from a literary family. Both his parents are authors, his mother most famously for Interview with the Vampire, among many other works. But Christopher was an adult when he discovered that writing fiction gave him the opportunity to tell the stories that he wanted to read, stories that were informed by his childhood love of chaos and camp. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, don't forget to head over to mattbaum.com to subscribe to my newsletter and take a look at my YouTube channel for videos about film and TV history. I just posted a video about the conflict over the sitcom Soap that engulfed America in the summer of 1977, and head over to my Patreon to support the Sewers of Paris and watch hours of bonus videos. I just posted a Patreon video that's an extended interview with Marcia Posner-Williams, producer of The Golden Girls and Soap and many other shows. Now, here's my conversation with Christopher Rice. Well, this week I'm talking to New York Times bestselling novelist Christopher Rice. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Two words, disaster movies.
Fantastic. I love both of those things.
Right. And specifically, I'm adding a word now, 70s disaster movies. I think there was something about The Towering Inferno, right? Like I was never the same after I saw that movie. And I think part of it might have been how my family spoke of it before I actually watched it, as this sort of big, semi-ridiculous, but also in various moments terrifying movie that had that 70s blueprint for anti-establishment, vaguely anti-capitalism, right? Like all unchecked development was going to lead us to disaster, right? But also with this swirling atmosphere of elegance and wealth and costume and nightlife, you know, it was just this, it was this recipe that I found intoxicating. I think part of it was because, and I wrote about this recently in an essay on Crime Reads, I was discovering at a very young age that I was incredibly drawn to scary movies, but I didn't really have the fortitude for them. You know, like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, in I think 1985, had a poster that scared me so badly I would have to hide under the seat of my aunt's van as we drove past the video store where it was. But there was something about the disaster film where all of the ingredients were perfectly calibrated for me. There was just enough fear, there was just enough suspense, and there was also really fabulous locations that this young little gay kid wanted to, you know, be in, you know, whether it was the SS Poseidon steaming across the ocean or the insanely tall glass tower, which didn't actually exist in San Francisco. We lived in San Francisco. I think that was another thing that amplified the movie's effect on me, is that it was the glass tower in the film is located in the spot where the Bank of America building is today. And I think for many years, the Bank of America building was the tallest building in San Francisco's skyline. But it is not the minute they pan up from the entry doors, it turns into a scale model and a studio somewhere, right? It stops being the real building the minute you look up, because it's something like 150 stories in the movie. It's almost a science fiction level height by the standards of the day. And yeah, I would make my parents take me down there. We would walk around. There was actually a rooftop restaurant at the time atop the Bank of America building called the Carnelian Room. Again, it was nothing like the rooftop restaurant where they all get stranded by the fire in the movie. But there was something about the collision of spectacle, pageantry, and chaos that just appealed to me, you know?
For folks who aren't familiar, I guess the title, The Towering Inferno, kind of tells you what you need to know. But like, right. how do you describe that movie for someone who's like, what's that?
Well, I tend to nerd out over the Hollywood politics of it. It was actually, I don't know if they've ever done anything like this again. There were two competing novels at the time that were each optioned by a different studio. And they essentially had the same premise, which is that a massive fire in a skyscraper, because this was the mid-70s. So the World Trade Center in New York still felt new and daring and audacious. And I think the Sears Tower, or what used to be known as the Sears Tower in Chicago, went up around this time. And so both of the books had the same premise. And I'm not really sure how they fared against each other as rival books. But when one movie studio realized they had optioned essentially the same story as another, they teamed up and decided to make the same movie. I guess it's similar to the way studios lined up to make Titanic, which everybody knew was going to be a hugely expensive film from Jim Cameron. And so I think it was like Paramount and 20th Century Fox pooled their resources. So they did the same thing about this movie. And the premise was a fire breaks out in the, on the sort of mid-level floors of what is the tallest building in the world at the time. And it's opening night. And all of the glitterati of San Francisco and West Coast society have all gathered to attend the opening night party at the rooftop restaurant. And the cast of this movie, I mean, this is another thing that the disaster films of the 70s offered up, was just everybody and their mother was in this movie. O.J. Simpson is in this movie. You know, Robert Wagner, I think, is in this movie. The other actor that always gets confused with Robert Wagner is also in this movie, and I'm blanking on his name in this moment. William Holden, Richard Chamberlain, Paul Newman and Steve McQueen, and you just spend the whole movie wanting them to make out because they're both so gorgeous, right? Like, and it was so I don't know which specifics were drawn from which novel, but I know that one of the novels I think was set in New York and the other was set on the West Coast, and so it just became this epic cast of a thousand, sprawling disaster story. But like I said earlier, they all had this, it's not really a twist, right? And I think when we were talking about this or emailing about this podcast, I was sort of like, where is the queer thread in this story that I maybe picked up on as a young person? And it's kind of a reach, but Richard Chamberlain is in this movie. And at the time he was closeted, but there were rumors, and he plays the electrician, right? And he has married into the family of the developer. And William Holden is the sort of patriarch who is conflicted and complicated, as all patriarchs are, right? Like he's overbearing and he's too aggressive, but he's got a soft side for his daughter. And there are more dimensions to his character. But you start to realize that the real villain is his son-in-law, played by Richard Chamberlain, who's in this sort of loveless marriage with William Holden's daughter. And it becomes steadily clear that the fire is breaking out because Chamberlain, as the electrician, his character, I should say, cut corners right and left. And of course, and it's that standard scene of, we couldn't have possibly built the building the way you would have wanted it if I had done everything to code and blah, blah, blah. But what emerges from him is this sort of, it's a very negative sort of queer coding, if you're going to read it that way, right? He's not in love with his wife. He married strategically. He's a little bit, he's a little bit queeny in his delivery of his lines, and he just sort of hates being there. He has this sense of a guy who's gotten trapped by his ambition. And he ultimately, you know, spoiler alert, I assume we're allowed to use spoilers.
Sure. I think the time has come.
Right. He dies terribly, but he dies. There are two sort of big final sequences that end the movie. And by the standards of today, they look very rickety and sluggish, right? But they were the big action pieces of the movie. And they attach something called a breeches boy, I believe it's called, from the broken out window of one of the restaurants to the rooftop of a neighboring building, which is not nearly as tall. So the last means of escape for these poor people is they have to get in this seat, this chair, and slide like on a high wire, you know, hundreds of stories above the city streets below from one building to the other. And they have to go one at a time. Well, Richard Chamberlain's character eventually decides he's sick of waiting and that he should go next. They're doing a sort of women and children first thing. And he triggers a mob scene that of course overrides the breeches boy, and the cable snaps and all these people go plummeting to their death. So, There's some queerness there, but it's really sublimated. And like I said, it would be very negative if we were to unpack it in that way today. But ultimately, and this was something I remember my father commenting on about the movie before I saw the movie, it has what he thought was one of the most lunatic twists or sort of saving plot lines, if you will, at the end. It turns out, which they only reveal at the very end of the movie, that the water tanks for all of the building are on the roof, directly above the restaurant, right? Mm-hmm. So after these hours, literally, it's like a 3-hour movie, right, of fighting this fire, you know, they say, well, the only thing we have left to do is to blow up these water tanks. And so that, of course, becomes the moment where they ask the heroic fireman, Steve McQueen, who has just descended from the upper heights of the building atop an exterior elevator that's almost been blown apart. And it's, you know, they had to helicopter it down. They say to him, we need you to fly up there and set explosive devices on these giant water tanks that have been sitting there the whole time and nobody has mentioned until now. And sure enough, they do. And that's ultimately what douses the fire. But I think it's also one of those movies that in retrospect, given what we, you know, the horrible events of 9/11, what we know about the construction of these buildings today, it doesn't really hold up from a technical standpoint. But I don't know if it should. You know, I don't know if that's the point. It's kind of an adventure fantasy that, again, lands on that message of, I think the last line of the movie is Steve McQueen and Paul Newman survive. They're standing on the steps of the building. And I think Steve McQueen, with his fireman's helmet under one arm, says to him, you know, someday you're going to talk to us about how to build these damn things. And it's, you know, it's meant to imply that the architect ran amok and it was all about ego and it was all about who could build the highest thing. And a chastened Paul Newman sort of nods and he walks off and this amazing John Williams music plays. And that's the end of the movie. So that's kind of the message that it tries to land on by the end.
You know, you noted the sort of negative queer coding of Richard Chamberlain. Was that something you were aware of? Like when you saw it, did that occur to you that was something that might be resonating? Like how aware of gayness were you at the time?
Well, I was very aware of gayness because we lived in the Castro district. So this okay. was when I was first encountering this movie. It was the early 80s. It was the Castro district. My mother was very close friends with many gay people. She had not achieved the success as a writer that she achieved just a few years later. 1988 was really the turning point for us. And we moved to New Orleans right around then. So I was very aware of it, but I was not used to seeing it depicted on film in any way. So I didn't know how to, I wasn't really clear on what the codes were. And I still think it's maybe a reach to characterize Chamberlain, the writing of the role that Richard Chamberlain played in the movie in that way. I think his portrayal of it, you know, emanated from him as a queer man, whether he was closeted or not. So I do remember thinking that his the venomous delivery of some lines had more in common with Bette Davis than the other ruggedly masculine men in the movie. You know what I mean? Because you got Paul Newman and Steve McQueen just butching it up and sort of standoffish with each other the whole movie. And then you've got the highly physical firefighting sequences that define it. And then you have Richard Chamberlain as this sort of conniving, you know, who can't really look anybody in the eye, you know.
What you're describing kind of reminds me of the way that often a Disney villain will be queer-coded.
Absolutely.
Did you feel like any identification with the gayness that you saw around you? Like when did that become something that you were like, oh, this might be me?
I vividly remember riding my bike. This is going to sound like a setup for something way creepier than it is, but and maybe it is in retrospect, but it was just a fleeting moment. I was riding my bike through the Castro District, our neighborhood in San Francisco, and this gay man, I whizzed past this gay man and he said, hey, good looking. And I remember not minding that he had said that. Now, in a child's mind, if I had stopped the bike, that might have been a setup for something way, way more inappropriate. But I remember thinking in those early years that it would not be a problem if that's who I grew up to be. I was sexually experimenting with other boys, or one in particular that I can remember. But I don't remember the sense of the identity sort of narrowing to a label. I felt that much more strongly when we moved to New Orleans. The juxtaposition between our lives in San Francisco culturally and New Orleans was like night and day. It was a profound culture shock to me. I went from a school where we were referring to our lesbian teachers by their first names to an Episcopal school, which Episcopal is like the lighter touch when it comes to Christian education. But to me, it felt like I had been dropped into a Catholic boarding school, right? I couldn't wear certain things to school. I was pressured to cut my rat tail, which was, you know, the fashionable hairstyle. It was sort of like a lighter version of the mullet, you know? I was dropped into a rigorous academic environment, a structured one with grades and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, we, in San Francisco, we had been protesting around the Capitol building, linking hands and shouting, "Freeze, please," you know, because we were in the height of the Cold War at the time. And we arrived in New Orleans at the moment of the Republican convention where the elder Bush was nominated and then eventually won the White House and succeeded Reagan. So it was they were very different worlds. And in that world, the question of what you were was sharper, right? And it, and I really did believe for an extended period of my adolescence that I was, in fact, bisexual, that I could make it work with a woman if I wanted to. I had romances and intrigues with other females, but the first time you kiss a man is going to be the answer to that question. And if you kiss a man and have a, and I mean a full body trembling response, you realize that what you have been experiencing with members of the opposite sex is like a skim milk version of what is out there to be experienced. And that was really, that was the moment, you know?
And was that what was, you know, those experiences, is that what was waiting for you in New Orleans?
It was, but I didn't really have them until I was 18. You know, I was really, I really cared too much what other people think of me. I really did. And so I was, despite what I wrote later, you know, and the depictions of high school that I had in my early books, I wasn't this out and proud kid. I was actively working to hide it. I was upset by any rumor that I wasn't 100% straight. I was, you know, I was more concerned. If I had it to do over again, and nobody does, I would be less concerned with other people's perceptions of me. And, but yes, I would say that the messy first moments of coming out of the closet really happened mostly in New Orleans. They happened around college too, but I didn't last in college very long. I came home and then I moved out to LA to sort of try to make a go of it in entertainment. And I never actually finished college. So there was a lot of French Quarter, gay bars. You know, my first date with a man, which was a seismic event for me at the time, happened in New Orleans. I remember almost, well, I remember most of it very clearly. He broke my heart. He broke up with me 2 weeks later, or actually 2 months later. I went out of town. And when I came back, his boyfriend had moved away to become a poet in London. And that didn't work out. So he was back. And that was my first heartbreak.
That's it. It does sound simultaneously messy and also very, I don't know, consistent with how those early romances kind of go when you're still figuring your way through them.
Indeed.
What was I was going to ask you? You mentioned the gay bars there and everything. How do and I realize like your age was very different, but the gay culture that you were aware of in San Francisco and New Orleans, how did they compare?
Well, you know, there were. Our moment, like me sort of not coming of age, but becoming cognizant of my surroundings, and right? Like 7, 8, 9, when you're sort of becoming, your mind is, you're developing memories that you can actually store, right? It was the middle of the AIDS crisis. It was a nightmare. It was, there were stores closing overnight up the street from our house. I remember Mom pointing out the long lines of grown men in the drugstore buying diapers and products that grown men didn't typically buy. It was awful. And I thought only in retrospect that, you know, I discovered accidentally at school that my parents had had a child before me who had died of leukemia. And they didn't want to tell me this when I was very young, obviously, because they thought it would upset me. And a teacher who didn't know I didn't know blabbed, essentially. She didn't blab, but she referenced it in class as a way. We were doing this unit on making family trees, and somebody made a joke about what do you do for a dead relative, a dead apple? And she said, the teacher was saying, that's not appropriate. We have many people here who have lost relatives. Christopher lost a sister. And I went, I most certainly did not. Ooh. I remember I answered very prim and proper, and the other kids actually laughed because I sounded like an adult. But so I think in retrospect, knowing what they went through made it hard for them to remain in the center of this community that was being decimated by this disease. They had really lived through a terrible illness and death of one of their own children. And I think that was part of the reason we moved to New Orleans. Okay, so you have that. And then in 1996, 97, when I'm coming out of the closet, believing that my decision to be openly gay is also going to be a decision to head into the middle of a plague that was still ongoing, there is, and I remember this very vividly. We went on a vacation to celebrate my graduation, and in the airport coming back, there was an article in the New York Times. I think the headline went something like, "New class of HIV drugs changes face of epidemic." And it was, of course, protease inhibitors, mm-hmm. which were, I mean, it was a stratospheric change. I don't know if people who didn't live through it can understand the gravity of what those drugs did to change the face of everything we had been through. And so suddenly there's less danger, but there's still a lot of grief, right? You're coming out into a community that law where if you meet a gay man, first of all, there's a certain demographic that's not entirely missing, but it's been leveled, right? And there are ghosts there, really, for lack of a better term. And if you meet an older man, it's very likely that he will not go to a funeral today because he had to go to so many, you know, during the mid-80s and late-80s and early-90s. It was just, it was awful. And so it was a community that was like relearning itself. We were coming out of this period of death. And, you know, I know people today who had to realign their lives because they were preparing to die. They were getting ready to sell everything. They had quit their jobs. They had thought, you know, my chances of survival with AZT alone are nothing. My mother had lost her dear friend, John Preston, the writer and activist. He had died a terrible death, you know. And suddenly that was all off the table. And suddenly men were going to live who had been ready to throw in the towel. And they were figuring out, how am I going to live? What do I want? And I think out of that came a period of a shift in political activism. There wasn't an abandonment of HIV and AIDS-related causes, but there was a growing sense of it as an international problem, right? There was a sense that the protease inhibitors that had done so much to change things here in the U.S. were not having the same global reach and global effects. And then gay marriage became the banner issue. And I like to think, like, when I came out, everyone thought gay marriage was a joke. They were like, you're out of your mind. There had been, I think, one ballot initiative in Hawaii, and everybody was like, this is never going to happen. And I watched over the course of my sort of gay adulthood that go from being a fringe issue, and also, I should add, a not very popular issue in the community. Like, there were a lot of people who thought, "What? Why is this going to become heteronormative gay marriage? We're selling out. We're adopting a stricter right." And I had a gay journalist friend of mine who was sort of blackballed at a local news magazine because he was the gay marriage guy. Like, the one who really went all the way in favor of gay marriage early on was Andrew Sullivan, who's always been a very controversial and divisive figure because he identifies as a conservative and has said these things. But, you know, and I had Dan Savage on the podcast I used to do with my producing partner, Eric Shaw Quinn, the Dinner Party Show. And he said it was like the gay community caught up with Andrew Sullivan, you know, that he had staked out this unpopular position. And then it became what so much of the community wanted. So that was really, it feels like, I think everybody wants to believe, particularly writers, because we have a big ego and we are storytellers. We want to believe that we were front row seats to the biggest and most seismic cultural changes one can imagine. But these were pretty big changes. I mean, to go from an era of mass death to having our rights affirmed in the highest court of the land, it feels like a pretty epic journey. And it also, I don't know if I'm qualified to make this decision. It feels like it happened fairly rapidly compared to a lot of other civil rights struggles.
Well, yeah, it certainly, you know, from my own experience, was something that really shifted very quickly. I think, you know, if I had to guess, it was because it was something that was turned into sort of a wedge issue and just got so much oxygen that it just turned into, you know, you couldn't avoid the conversation.
Right. No, you really couldn't. And I think you're right. I think what happened was there was a court in Massachusetts that made a pretty decisive verdict in favor of it. And there was an enormous amount of pressure put on President George H.W. Bush at the time to take a public stand. And I think there was a belief that it was going to get out the votes. I think it's what's being done right now with trans children, right? I think that when, you know, there are similarities that I'm seeing when conservatives are losing on another front, they turn to the culture wars, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's happening right now. I think, you know, there are those of us who are horrified by Donald Trump, as I was and am, we can point to the fact that he is the fact that he managed to squeak through to the presidency even once is a horrifying statement on the mood of this country. Right. But at the same time, he lost the popular vote twice. You know, there's a real crisis happening on the right side of things right now. And I think they have used this issue of trans children in an abominable way. And it reminds me very much of how gay marriage was used during a time when the Iraq war was turning into an international catastrophe and a total failure of neoconservative principles on the world stage, you know? So anyway, I feel like I'm taking us away from what you really wanted to talk about today, but it is fascinating. You know, and I'm no fan of, I think George W. Bush is responsible for the worst foreign policy disaster in history, which is the Iraq war, which was an unjustified war that killed a staggeringly high number of people, both American and Iraqi civilians. And, you know, so I'm not a great defender of his, but at the same time, there was an audio recording released of him saying that he didn't want to meet with James Dobson, the head of the Focus on the Family, who was arguably the most organized and I think vicious anti-gay marriage activist at the time, because he knew how to play the game, right? But W's on this recording talking to a friend saying, I don't want to meet with Dobson because he's going to make me go after the gays. And I'm a sinner and we're all sinners, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I remember thinking at the time, as others pointed out, that when he made the announcement that he was going to pursue an amendment to the Constitution to ban gay marriage, he didn't even look up from the piece of paper he was reading from. Mm-hmm. I think it was Andrew Sullivan actually who wrote about that. He couldn't even look into the cameras and defend this thing he was doing, because as you pointed out, it was being pressured on him as a wedge issue. Again, not a big defender of George H.W. Bush, but I think it's important to see the context in these things.
So with all the, you know, different phases of gay existence, like moving from the 80s into the 90s and 2000s, and all the different places that you've lived and experiences you've had, I'm curious if the aesthetic of those disaster movies that initially drew you in, was that something that continued through those, you know, the opulence and the chaos and all that stuff? Was that something that remained attractive to you?
Oh, absolutely. There's a quote from Death in Venice. I'm going from Towering Inferno to Death in Venice. I know it's quite a pivot. And I'm going to misquote it, but I used it in my first novel a lot because it meant so much to me. And I think it goes something on the order of, for passion, like disease, does not sit well with the sure and even course of everyday life. It welcomes every loosening of the social fabric. And it goes on to sort of explicate that idea. And I think what I take from that is anyone who feels like they don't belong is not necessarily going to resort to predatory actions, but they welcome any event that shakes up the power structure, the orderly flow of things, that is designed to benefit and profit people who are not like them. Mm-hmm. So in the disaster movie, as well as in the horror movie, I think outsiders always find great comfort in those things, because there is a sense that when the scales are leveled, it doesn't matter if you're straight, it doesn't matter if you're black or white, everyone is going to have to pick up the nearest available weapon and fight against the oncoming threat, whether it's a fire or a monster or a masked madman. I think slasher movies fail at this because it's so weighted in the other direction necessarily, but that disaster movie DNA, like the idea that everyone in its most glib form and easiest form, it doesn't matter how rich you are or how poor you are, right? Like there's the, you know, Independence Day, the Roland Emmerich film, is sort of an inheritor of the disaster movies that I'm talking about, but it goes off in kind of its own directions with. But the classic example is Will Smith's stripper wife ends up taking care of the first lady because the first lady's helicopter has been crashed in Los Angeles by the alien attack, right? Mm-hmm. That collision of worlds, which is often very sentimental and whatever, I think that could be very exciting for queer people when they're watching it as a young person. Because if I was up on that, in that rooftop restaurant with all those people, nobody would give a shit that I was gay. Hmm.
Yeah. You know, one of the films that really sticks in my mind from that period is Airport 75. For having like the sheer ridiculousness of the premise. It's a giant airplane full of, you know, everybody has some dramatic twist to their life on this airplane. Oh, yeah. I think that's the one with Gloria Swanson where.
Oh, it is. It is. It really is. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm talking too much, so I'm letting you go. But yeah, you just touched on another one that I just think is that one is beyond Towering Inferno. It is just a sort of deliciously terrible movie, you know, for the reasons that you just described. Yes, Gloria Swanson. It's really important. It's important to me. It's not important to many other people. That is the movie. That is the airport movie that inspired the first Airplane movie. And so all the jokes in Airplane that you might love have a reference point in Airport 1975. There's a sick girl on the plane who needs to be flown to her kidney in an hour's time, right? Yeah, Gloria Swanson is on the plane. It's just – and the premise is that a little Cessna collides with the cockpit and it's left to Karen Black, of all people, the chief flight attendant, to fly the plane, which you think, oh, this is going to be this great story of female empowerment, but she's terrible. And eventually they have to helicopter in Charlton Heston into the cat, right? So the plane has had to fly so low because she has no idea what she's doing. And she's too quote unquote hysterical to take direction from the ground crew. And yeah, it's really a delicious camp fest.
You know, the word that you used there, camp, is exactly what I was going to say. It's just so absurdly over the top and fun that I wonder if that's one thing that differentiates these movies from horror, in that it sounds like you like scary movies, but you don't like to be scared too much.
I don't like to be – this is going to strike some people as crazy, because there are some images in my books that I think skirt on the edge of this, but I don't like torture. And I don't like prolonged scenes of watching people suffer physical agony. And that a few years ago became the dominant theme in all horror movies. Torture porn was a phenomenon. And I could barely bring myself to watch the television commercials. There was something about that being, you can tell I'm not that into BDSM, because like, I don't want to be tied up, you know, like I don't, but, there's something about that complete loss of power and that complete degradation, and sadism is not really my favorite thing. But a churning environment that allows people's churning emotional life to boil to the surface, I think, is what the disaster movie offers.
What were the other films that were important to you, you know, as a kid, maybe going into adulthood?
I'll tell you the one that was really, and I thought about making it more the focus of our conversation today, because I think it's really right on the line of what I just described, was Jaws. And I'm not alone in this, and I think it's a universal defining movie for a lot of people, gay, straight. You know, it is an absolutely terrifying film. And as my best friend, Eric Shaw Quinn, who I do my podcast with, has pointed out often, and he's not the first one to say it, the genius of that movie is that it went wrong. And I think there's an inspiring story in there for artists and creators. The reason that movie is so scary is because the shark didn't work. They put the mechanical shark in the water off Martha's Vineyard where they shot the movie. They had never tested it in salt water, and it just went haywire. And so they couldn't do this like Godzilla style monster shark movie where you saw the shark every 5 minutes and all this sort of stuff. So he had to deal with what you couldn't see. And that made it terrifying. And there is, in my opinion, there was my childhood before I saw the opening scene of Jaws, when the young woman skinny dips and swims out into the ocean, and then you just see her from above the surface as she's dragged back and forth. And you have to imagine what the shark is like under the surface, what the shark is doing to her under the surface. It's just terrifying. It's a terrifying scene. But it also satisfies that level of adventure, right? It culminates with these three men of different temperaments and different versions of masculinity. I think you could argue one is the Richard Dreyfuss character, very nerdy, very bookish, very sciencey, not a big guy. And then you've got Quint, the mad boat captain and shark hunter, who's been traumatized by a war experience. And then you've got the sheriff, who's the sort of staid and orderly and controlling guy. Those three men have to team up and go out and hunt this beast. And ultimately it comes to a very satisfying conclusion, before you later learn that apparently there were four other sharks hanging out there waiting for their own terrible sequel. So, right. But you know, that was very much a defining movie. And it's fascinating. My emotional response to this question is I feel like these are not gay enough answers. Right? Like, I feel like I should be saying The Women or Steel Magnolias and all of those movies did play a role, but there was a thirst for, you know, I think what I described previously, the sense of a, not necessarily just a traumatic event, but a disruptive event that opened the door for anyone to be the solution.
Well, I think something that's sort of a common thread among all those movies, and also something that does strike me as pretty queer, is that they're all stories where you can't trust the people in charge. They don't
Yes.
know what they're doing, and they don't have anyone's best interest at heart except their own. So it's up to the little guys to, you know, to save the day.
Totally. I totally agree with that. Absolutely. It's there in Towering Inferno, as I described, where, you know, they didn't build the building right and rampant development led to this disaster. The mayor in Jaws doesn't want to close the beaches. He's not perceiving the threat accurately. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's totally true.
Was that something that you put into your own work? And when did you, you know, start either writing or at least thinking of yourself as a writer?
Well, you know, I thought of myself as an actor up until I went to college, and nobody there thought of me as an actor. Okay. So I backed off that. And I, you know, as I like to say, I wanted a creative outlet that nobody could stop me from utilizing. Mm-hmm. And that was writing. Nobody could stand in between me and the computer and tell me not to write. They didn't have to do anything with it once I finished, but I could go into a creative flow state sitting there at my computer. And I transferred from Brown University, where I was at the time, to NYU's film school. And I lasted there about a semester, I think, because I really just wasn't ready for college in general. I don't know if I'm like, I dream of going back to college now and just being a scholar, right? You know, just sort of sinking into subjects that I love. But at the time I was restless and I wanted to be out in the world. And I ultimately got out to LA and Hollywood as soon as I could. And granted, I had a lot of assistance and a lot of privilege and a lot of family money helping me, you know, change my mind on a moment's notice. And I cringe when I think about how adolescent some of the decisions were that I made then. But I didn't really see myself as a writer until I made that transfer to NYU and actually began studying screenwriting, because I was obsessed with the movies. Television to some degree, but kind of a narrow band of television when I was a young person. Television wasn't what it was today, right? And so that's when I really saw myself as a writer. But I wrote a book almost by accident. I wrote a short story that a friend invited me to read at a reading series here in LA. And it got such a response from the crowd that I decided to tinker with it. I was living out here. I was trying to put film projects together with a friend of mine. I got a call that my mother had suffered a diabetic episode and didn't know she was diabetic. She'd been close to death. And so I dropped everything and I flew home. And in my off time, as I sort of sat by her bed during her recovery, I began tinkering with this story, and it became my first novel, A Density of Souls. But before that moment, if I had made it part of a plan, I would have lost my confidence and my nerve, you know. And that's really, I like to say that, you know, I got a 2-book contract, which was great. And it was in the writing of the second book that I realized this is who I am. Because what was becoming clear is that when it came to writing, I was willing to do the heavy lifting. When it came to acting, I really wasn't. You know, when it started being no, I quit. You know, and God, if you quit at the first sign of no in any creative profession, there's not much in store for you. You know, because it's a lifetime of no. You know, even for those of us who have privilege behind us.
Do you remember, was there a particular moment when you made that realization that the writing, that being a writer was working for you, that you were willing to put in the work?
It was writing my second novel. It was mm-hmm. The Snow Garden, because I thought this is a lot harder than writing a first novel in a weird way. Because with the first novel, A, you don't have a lot of bad reviews in your head. Mm-hmm. But secondly, you are... you've been waiting your whole life to write it. It's been building up inside of you. But the second one was oh my God, I've got to build a story. I've got to sit and interrogate who these characters are, and they can't just be the same characters that I did in the last book. And it was a much more rigorous and exhausting process. And when I realized how much I wanted to see it through and how much I wanted another book out there, that's when I realized I was a writer.
Did you find yourself putting, the campy elements that you loved from the films into your books? Was that something that...
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, my father hated it. The first book has a hurricane in it. A hurricane strikes New Orleans and floods the streets. I mean, there's just water everywhere. And it's that sense of, again, it's introducing lawlessness so that the real villains can emerge. And they, you know, the real villain is wanted by everyone for bombing a gay bar in the French Quarter, and he uses the storm as cover to come back in. So all of it was in there. And he just thought, what is this frigging hurricane about? And I remember my mother from the other room saying, don't you tell him to cut those scenes. Those are bestseller scenes. Those are going to sell the book. And then the second book, maybe less so, because what happened between books one and two was that I had been told by enough people, both negatively and positively, that I had written a mystery and a thriller, even though I had thought it was, you know, the next great American novel, and how could that be classified, right? So I began to read a lot of contemporary mysteries, and The Snow Garden was very much crafted along those lines. I wanted it to read like a Patricia Cornwell novel or a Jonathan Kellerman novel with queer characters on a college campus, you know, in the Northeast. Whereas A Density of Souls is a much more, I don't know if I want to call my own work chaotic, but it is much more a story in which chaos governs, you know?
Yeah. Well, so tell me about the response that you got once those books were out there and you started building a reputation as an author. How did that change your life?
Oh, I think that it's been a fascinating journey because I have not written the same thing every time out. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel like A Density of Souls offered up a blueprint that could be repeated, nor do I think a first novel should be repeated over and over again. You know, it's hard to look at your first novel. If you're lucky enough to do this, it's hard to look back at where you were at the beginning, because I feel like I know so much more now about writing and the structure of it and the process of it. But it was, it became my entire focus, you know, and it became, I did have to talk to myself and kind of sit myself down and stop viewing it as a lesser form of writing than screenwriting or television. And I think a lot of that is because I live in Los Angeles and, there may not be the same level of cash involved, but I have met enough really accomplished screenwriters and TV writers who have an enormous amount of envy of the novelist, no matter how many books you sell or no matter how much you get paid, because it is your vision. You know, it's editorial feedback is never as intrusive as studio or network feedback.
Oh, sure. Ever. Yeah.
You know, like it's just never as intrusive because, you know, and in many cases, it's because there's not as much money on the line. There's not production money on the line. The production of a book doesn't hold a candle to the production of a movie or a television series. So there's less anxiety, but nobody ever, and I don't know if any author has ever gotten out and said they think their book failed because they had a bad editor. You know, I think it's still your book at the end of the day. And so I really became committed to that process. And I think it's something very valuable and precious. And all of this is really born out of the fact that I'm a voracious reader. I would rather, no matter what we're doing at any given time in the day, I would rather be reading a book. And so I really write so that I have something to read each day, or an excuse to read each day, because I got to read over my own work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I love the, that kind of, I guess, inversion of what I would have expected. You know, that you mentioned having to come to terms with your conception of writing as being somehow lesser, writing a book being somehow lesser than writing for TV and film. And I don't know, I think a lot of people might think of it the other way around, that there's something much more noble about literature than about media that appears on the screen.
I think you're right. And I think it depends on where you live, to be completely frank. I have to say, right shortly after I moved here, I was having coffee with a really famous film director who basically said to me, who has time to read all these books? You know, it was like, it was the most jaded Hollywood, you know, whatever. And so I feel like I've been negatively impacted by being surrounded by that viewpoint. And I think being surrounded by this idea in a lot of circles in Hollywood that books once optioned need to be dramatically changed before they can work as film and television shows. So I think that, you know, I just think that it is more a matter of how you think as an artist you can best get your vision across. And I think there is a class of writer that they are primarily cinematic and visual storytellers. And even though the process demands of them that they ultimately give up their work to the director, to the studio, to the network, that is how they best tell a story. And they are drawn to that. And if you had asked me this question 20 some odd years ago, I would have told you I was that type of writer. I would have told you I'm not capable of writing a novel. And what I've discovered is I don't feel that way anymore. And the joy of writing the novel is that you're the production designer, you're the set designer, you're the you're casting, you're everything. It's your whole vision. So if you are somebody who came up on the movies, it's like creating your very own movie without anybody else's interference.
Why did you feel that you weren't capable of writing a novel?
You know, when you're dealing with just the raw format of a screenplay, right, you are not actually putting very many words on the page. I think everybody today is familiar with how the page of a screenplay looks like. You are conveying your message through minimalism. You are revealing through dialogue what you cannot reveal through anything else, right? It's almost like a haiku compared to a one-man show. And when you describe it that way initially, there seems to be this terrible, overwhelming burden that a novel brings with it. It's the negative side of what I just described very positively. How are you going to be the production designer? How are you going to do the costumes? It seems like, in the beginning, an overwhelming amount of minutiae and detail. And I think what you come to discover is that a good story is an organizing force in a novel, just as it is in a screenplay. You know, Eric Jacquin, my co-host on TDPS Presents Christopher and Eric, we go around all the time. He went to a Robert McKee seminar when he was new to Los Angeles. And Robert McKee, who's never written a novel, would say of screenplay, oh, it's so much harder than writing a novel. And the implication he was making was that, well, in a novel, you can just go on forever and say absolutely whatever you want and include every detail, whereas you don't have time in a movie. And I've said, who has ever described a good novel by saying he went on forever and included every detail and just said whatever he wanted? When has that ever been just a positive description of a novel? And so you still actually have the same challenges, right? You're still asked to include what is essential to your story in both mediums. And I think that's why today it seems like less of a dividing line, and also one is not qualitatively superior to the other.
How did you find the, I guess, I don't know if it's confidence or just the, you know, the mettle to become all those different roles, to become the production designer and the costumer and the makeup and hair, you know, all those different things that you get to be or have to be when you write a book. How did you get over that feeling of like, how can I do all this?
Well, you know, I think that there's that sort of, I don't know what part of the brain that anxiety would come from, but there's the sort of self-analytical, self-critical side of our brains. And then there's the compulsive side of our personalities that can't be stopped in many instances. And with me, writing was a compulsion. I couldn't be stopped. From a very young age, I would write a million first chapters, you know, and when I was really young, they were just sort of emulating books I had read, you know, chapter one, Webster walked into the room. It was red, carnelian red, because someone had taught me the word carnelian the day before. And then it would peter out and it would be whatever. But there was this desire of like, there were all these little stone strikes of trying to crack this stone. And that went on until I was older. And so I think you have a compulsive desire to put words on the page, to build a world through words that will drive you no matter what you're telling yourself about what you can and can't do.
Have you found the thing that drives you or your area of focus, has that shifted from, you know, the beginning of your, when you were writing books, when you thought of yourself as a writer or a novelist, you know, what was it when you began? What did you want to explore then? And what do you like to explore now?
You know, when I began, I really felt like I had a very basic desire to see myself in potboilery, stories that were inspired by the nighttime soap operas I had watched during the 80s and 90s. You know, I really wanted to write something big and commercial with a gay kid at the center of it. And typically in the spot where you would typically find a straight female character, right? The ingenue was now going to be a gay guy. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to refigure that. And that's really what Density of Souls is. The every character's world in that book orbits around a beautiful, young, abused gay kid who is trying to sort of empower himself and transcend the abuse in his past. And that was really my agenda in the beginning. I think as I have gone on, the trend line seems to be, thematically, secrets kill. Which is, I'm hardly the first writer to zero in on this subject, but that's really what galvanizes me. Secrets kill. The parts of yourself that you sublimate, which are not outright criminal or destructive. We all have to sublimate some things that are destructive or criminal. But the parts of your authenticity that you sublimate are going to come for you, whether you like it or not. So you can try to hold them back and you can hold them down, but you will pay a price. That's really, I think, the theme of most of my stories that I have told. And everything else has kind of shifted around that. You know, for instance, I just published probably, I'm launching an acknowledged pen name, as it's called, C. Travis Rice. Mm-hmm. And it is for beachy, sexy, sunny, gay romance novels. And that is still the theme. Right? The packaging has changed and the pen name is about, even though it's out there, it's about letting my readers know that this is going to be something that's tonally different from your average Christopher Rice novel. But it's still the same story. If you cannot be your greatest responsibility is to be yourself, right? And if you let something get in the way of that for you, it becomes your burden to remove it. Mm. And I think that's the idea behind Sapphire Sunset, even though it's set at an Orange County beach resort and the boys are beautiful and falling in love and all this sort of stuff. And they hold hands and that's, you know, it's like a Nora Roberts novel with two dudes, which is something I've wanted to write for a long time, but that's still the theme.
That sounds extremely appealing. Tell me more about Sapphire Sunset what it's about and where people can look forward to reading it.
Well, it's available from every digital retailer. If you would like to get it in your store, I recommend that you ask for it because they do have the ability to order it and keep it in stock. I became aware a couple years ago that what is called male-male romance was becoming a thing, if you will. Mm-hmm. It was becoming a segment of digital publishing. Wasn't anything as big as it is now. But it was growing, and I had a very negative initial reaction to it. I had been told that for years, predominantly female authors had been on the internet writing love stories between Spock and Kirk. It was at one point it was called Slash. You know, it may still be called that, but it's gained such mainstream acceptance as a publishing segment that I don't know if that term still resonates with people. And I thought, what the hell do these women know? And I thought, so I went online and I just said, okay, this is contempt prior to investigation. I gotta investigate this. So I downloaded two different books and they were clearly by female authors. And even in the moment I was thinking, well, Patricia Nell Warren was a female author and she wrote The Front Runner, which many people regard as a beloved gay classic. Why would I be hostile to these women over doing the same thing? And I read these two books simultaneously, right? Because I thought there's no way they can satisfy me by their own. And I just absolutely adored them. And I adored them for being what they were, which was a commercial romance that satisfied the promise of the same promises that a Harlequin novel or a Boone and Mills, I think, is the British version of Harlequin. It satisfied that. And this is why, because I had a moment where the sex was reading as authentic to me and passionate, while still very much a romance novel. It was good sex, but the body parts were not in the wrong places. You know, clearly these women had done a lot of research, I should say. And emotionally, I felt like they were tapping into the romantic fantasies that I have as a gay man. But I realized halfway through both of them, these men aren't going to die. And it was like a warm wash poured down my body, right? Because I had for years been reading, as we all had, wonderful, beautifully written, tragic, politically urgent social chronicles of the AIDS epidemic, you know, tales of loss and the reality, you know, deeply wrought literary fiction about what arguably a predominantly white urban gay community had been going through during these years, right? And I needed a break. I needed a break. And I love the idea of settling into this soft, sexy, more genre world in which gay men could be anything, because that was a thing that was happening in these books. We were firemen. We were wolf shifters. We were, there's a whole segment where we can get pregnant, you know, like it seemed like a version of the ideal all gay TV network in my mind, where you could just change the channel and find gay people doing a whole different set of things on a different show. And I became determined over the years to write one. And, but I really hesitated for reasons which I think are weird and complicated, but I think I knew how. For one, there's the stigma around the romance label, right? And I had been known for writing really scary, dark, edgy things for most of my career. But you also have to write about your fantasies in a way that's really frank and open and may subject you to ridicule in a way that a darker novel may not, you know, because a negative focus is considered far more culturally acceptable than a positive one.
So now you've got this as a series, right? There's Sapphire Spring and yes. Sapphire Cove and a whole bunch, right?
Sapphire Sunset is the first one, and Sapphire Spring is coming out in September. And they're structured. It's a kind of classic romance construction, which is you can hop on at any point. Every book is about a different couple, or possibly a throuple in the future. But every book is about a different relationship, and it tells that relationship story.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really exciting. So Sapphire Sunset is the one that's out now. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And yes. We look forward to more in the future. And you've also got a podcast with your friend Eric.
Absolutely. To Christopher and Eric, you can find it at thedinnerpartyshow.com. We're also on every podcast platform. Eric is my best friend, and we did a celebrity interview show and sketch comedy show forever called The Dinner Party Show. And I saw these podcasts that were taking off, and I thought, well, these are just sort of conversations, you know, going deep, like we're doing right here. And I said, Eric, we could do this. We could do a version of this that's easier on us logistically. And he said, that's great, but we need a focus. And he came up with Christopher and Eric's True Crime TV Club. And so we watch a documentary. We watch either an hour of it or multiple episodes, and we serve it up for our listeners so that you don't have to watch it. Because to be honest, most of what we watch is not the higher tone stuff. We watch a lot of the trashy sort of wives with knives and all that sort of stuff. But we had this experience recently, and we're getting back into it, right? So we watched 1 hour of television about a crime, and in it, it was revealed that the victim was gay, and he was murdered while meeting men at a hookup spot outside an adult bookstore in Miami Beach. And we had questions about the depiction of he was closeted and married to a woman. And we had questions about the depiction of the wife's involvement in the case. Did she disavow him? She sort of drops out of the story. So I went and I watched another, true crime special about this same murder. And in it, with my jaw on the floor, I saw that they had invented a reenactment with an actor playing a prosecutor who read a fake closing statement in which this man was really at a straight strip club and was shot outside in a botched robbery. I mean, this is an actual story, and this special changed the story of it to erase this man's actual sexuality. And we thought, how many times have we been lied to in the course of talking about these single hours of television? So we're going to go back. We're going to do a compare and contrast, and we're going to check this series specifically, which is called The Perfect Murder, to see when else they might have done this, because it's a difficult thing. I mean, you're talking about a murder victim, right? But you're also talking about an erasure of a murder location, which could be information that keeps other gay men from being targeted or attacked. There's just a lot that happens when you erase somebody's sexuality. I mean, you're already making a gratuitous hour of television about this man's death. You're going to draw the line there. So anyway, that's the type of conversation we get into a lot on our podcast.
Well, and I think, especially when you look at media, the queer people are sadly accustomed to, being left out or overlooked or straight washed or whatever you want to call it.
Absolutely. We actually spoke about, I believe, a YouTube video that you did comparing an episode of Murder, She Wrote with an episode of Starsky and Hutch. This was you, right? I don't have this wrong.
Yeah, that was mine.
We were, because there was, and it was fascinating because I remember Eric and I watched Murder, She Wrote as well. And they did this whole episode in a drag club in San Francisco. I think it was 1985. And everybody in the episode is, all the drag queens are straight. There's not even a whiff of gay people.
Yeah.
This whole episode.
It's wild. It's absolutely wild. But, you know, you think about like what, particularly in a Murder, She Wrote audience, but, you know, what a mainstream television audience would have been looking for in the early 1980s. I think drag queens would have been a little too bold for CBS or whatever. I think, no, was it NBC or CBS? I think it was CBS because
it was CBS. Yeah,
she was programmed opposite. In the end, Murder, She Wrote was opposite Friends, which is just wild to think about.
Oh my God, that makes me feel so old. Actually, it makes Murder, She Wrote seem really old.
Isn't that crazy? Because it seems like it's a show that basically grew out of the 70s. And then to think about that happening, competing with Friends seems like it's just another time.
It's just, yeah, it's like two eras that shouldn't quite meet, but do.
Mm. Well, and, you know, we didn't get a chance to talk about, like you mentioned, we were actually emailing me about this, soap operas, primetime soaps of the 1980s. And, you know, I'm just going down a research rabbit hole in Stephen Carrington, a character who was very perplexingly straight washed on Dynasty.
Oh, wait, did they straight wash him?
Well, yeah, it's this very peculiar thing where he insists for the entire run of the show that he's homosexual, but he has relationships with Heather Locklear and some other women. And it's only by the end of the series in 91 that Stephen can really fully be in a same-sex relationship. But
wow, I did. Yeah. You know, because I remember watching that show as a child, but not picking it up from the beginning and not really even being aware that Stephen was gay. It was like something somebody had mentioned months before that they never got back to. Because I remember loving the show, but I remember being entirely fixated on Alexis and Crystal, you know. And I remember in the San Francisco bars of our neighborhood, they would paint the windows when a big fight episode was coming up. You know, Alexis and Crystal were going to go into the fountain and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, so it felt very queer for that reason. But yeah, I think we are in such a better place with representation than we were. I know there are still problems and there are still issues and it's always going to be evolving. But I just think if there was going to be a gay character in anything back then, it was going to be the only gay character you were going to see for years. And so the pressure that came to bear on it was enormous. You know, how was it going to represent? What was it going to say about the community? This is our one shot. That's how it always felt.
Well, I'm excited that you're, you know, excavating the older stories and shining some light on the actual truth of them. And also, you know, giving us the representation in the, you know, literary genres that I think people have been waiting a long time for.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, Christopher, thanks again so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Matt.
Thanks to Christopher for joining me, and thanks to you for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbound to support the show and get backer rewards like stickers in the mail and exclusive bonus videos. Check out my YouTube for deep dives into pop culture history at youtube.com/mattbound and my newsletter at mattbound.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin McLeod of incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.